Hello, John.
Yes, Adam. Hello.
Well, thank you very, very much for agreeing to come on the podcast. Now, I have been listening to your work and unfortunately haven't had time to read as much as you have on your site, but I find that the talks that you've been giving on your website are some of the best that I've heard, because it's really, really rare to hear someone speak with such clarity and focus about mystical topics, about the things that you have studied and the things that you are experiencing. So to me, this is a great opportunity to be able to talk to you.
Well, for me as well, Adam. Thank you.
So we were talking earlier about the nature of psychonautics, and on your site is this wonderful section on psychonautics, and we were talking about going in this direction to talk about psychonautics. Obviously, my site is Chronicles of the Psychonaut, and there seems to be a massive awakening happening, and we seem to be experiencing ourselves in general on more and more multidimensional levels.
I agree with you.
So, and as Michael Tessarian says, we are in this time of revealing. And I think not only does the darkness become revealed in this time, the light becomes revealed as well.
Everything becomes revealed, yeah.
Yeah, it all becomes clearer.
Yes, I think a time of revealing is a very helpful expression. I've used the term planetary shift.
Exactly.
Which other people have also used. And as in my understanding of planetary shift, it means that something is shifting with the entire planet, with the entire human species, but we need to understand, rather than speculating wildly about that, we need to try to understand how that shift is taking place in each side, inside of each one of us, one person at a time, as it were. Yeah, it's a series called Rapture and Revolution, which is on the sister site of metahistory.org, which is futureprimitive.org. And there's quite a number of talks with me and Joanna Harcourt Smith on Future Primitive, but there is a group called Rapture and Revolution in which I talk about mysticism.
Yes, and I will put a link on the show notes for
sure.
That too. Now, I found your description was really, really helpful for me, because for one, my very first podcast, I brought up this entheogenic meditation as opposed to direct, you know, experience meditation.
Without the use of plants.
Yeah, without the use of any plants. Because it was a current debate that was happening on a few different forums. And without going into that whole thing again, I found that you seem to be very, very clear on that. And what I understand is that these plant medicines, and I do want to make the distinction between plant medicines and chemical psychotropics.
Yes, that's important, and I make that distinction too.
Exactly. And when you're talking, and now shamanism is such a broad term, people even use that word to mean they're just having an experience with some form of psychotropic.
You have to be very specific in talking about plant medicines and distinguishing them from chemicals, I think. It's important to understand mysticism.
Well, I personally haven't experienced any man-made chemical substance beyond LSD that I would actually qualify as any kind of help at all.
I've also experienced LSD, of course. I belong to the generation of the 60s, which was the first generation in America and in Europe to really experience LSD in millions and millions of cases. People were taking LSD. And I would say this about LSD, which is it is practically the only chemical psychotropic I've taken. I did take some mescaline, and my opinion of LSD is that it can be very helpful as a therapeutic tool, Of course, this has been proven by a vast amount of medical and scientific research, so that's not big news. But if you would ask me how LSD compares to the natural plant medicines provided by Gaia, I would say that it's more like trainer wheels. It's sort of like riding a bicycle with trainer wheels. You might be able to take an LSD trip and get a sense of where you would go with the psychoactive plants. But when you go with the psychoactive plants themselves, the journey is much deeper and much, much more profound.
I found when I was beginning my experiences with LSD, I was coming from a place where I had already been taught how to enter into trance and shamanic practices before ever having any LSD experiences.
And well, you're very lucky in that respect.
I thought
so. Your involvement with indigenous practices, extremely lucky.
Well, what I found was that when I was using this one, I would use it in the, as Leary said, I focused on set and setting, but also I found intention, especially at the moment of ingesting anything, was crucial as to, in a sense, the direction.
I mean, absolutely.
You can't get in a car and just start driving without, you know, looking down the road. So that's your intention. You focus, and a lot of people are, in a sense, diving off the diving board into the pool with absolutely no intentions.
Well, that's the difference between recreational use, which has really no intention.
Yeah, exactly.
And a more focused experimental mysticism, or a more a mysticism that has more purpose and direction to it. And of course the latter is the kind of practice that I would encourage people today, so that we can form a sense of direction and get a sense of direction for this planetary shift that we're all involved in.
Yeah, I think there's a huge difference between I think it was Bob Marley, he said, many are called, but few are chosen. And I don't truly believe that there's any godlike entity choosing anybody. I think it's a choice you make yourself.
It is definitely a choice you make yourself. It's a self-selecting process.
Yeah. And what I find is that, you know, many people have awakening experiences, and then they go on with their day-to-day life, and that's evidenced by the 60s. How many full-on hippies became yuppies and then became corporate slaves and then forgot.
I know.
All
Let me tell you, I lived through that, and I have to tell you that it was very, very shocking and very depressing.
Yeah.
Because I was just 16 or 17 years old at the height of the euphoria of the 60s, and then the 70s came. And I can tell you that by the early 70s, like 1972 or 1974, it was so obvious that a lot of the people who had been involved in the psychedelic revolution had just completely lost that inspiration, and they had just sunken into yuppieism and into a kind of narcissism.
Yeah.
And that was the fate of many people of that generation, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, I think me and you were about a decade apart, because at that time that you're talking about in the 70s, I was like, hey, you know, where'd the party go?
Right. Well, the party went.
Like,
bottom dropped out of the
minute,
party.
You know, I'm just now old enough. You know,
yeah.
I was four. And
you know, it's interesting, Adam, that this subject of what happened to many members of the psychedelic revolution is still very relevant today, because I think that we face an important question here about the awakening, this moment of revealing, if you want to call it that, and that is how we can stay on course, as it were, you know? I think that there's no question whatsoever that more and more people, especially in the younger generation, people in their 20s and 30s and up into their 40s, are having momentous experiences of awakening right now. They are beginning to see reality in a different way. They're beginning to connect to the planetary intelligence and to see things in different dimensions. They're beginning to understand how mind-controlled we are and how the world is run by these mental programs and by the media and by disinformation. And so at this critical moment, when people are awakening, it's particularly important for us to understand how we can stay on course with this awakening process and not lose it, because that's what really happened in the 60s to a great many people. They got a glimpse of a kind of enlightenment, and then it just dissipated. And I think we would do well to learn from that time, how to do better.
Exactly. It's well, I found that in one way, you know, I feel that maybe there's some, you could never question the timing, you know. If it didn't happen then, it's because people weren't ready. That's the way I look at it. And that would I think align us to this time quite nicely. And I think that the people that did hold on to their ways, they became elders in their community, yourself as an example, and have really helped, especially now, you know, this young era of psychonauts. And I think it's really interesting that people are gravitating to the term psychonaut, because it does imply a more interactive awareness of what's happening. You are becoming the pilot of your vessel. You're not just you know, hair in the wind, hanging your head out the window.
That's right. That's right. It implies a navigation, psychonauts, and then therefore it implies the capacity to navigate and the ability to keep on course and keep a sense of direction. You know, Adam, there's something that I'd like to discuss in this context, and something that I'd like to say that was triggered by something you said before our interview. You asked me how you didn't. You said you didn't know how old I was, but you would consider me an elder.
Exactly.
A friend of mine once said to me, "John, you're as old as it gets." and I always think of that as a very loving thing to say. But the fact is that I am in my early 60s, and I am a kind of veteran and an elder in some respects. And I'm coming to understand what that means. And I would like to say something to younger people who may be listening to this podcast. You mentioned that the majority of your listeners perhaps might be of the younger generation. And I would like to say,
at least many.
Yes, that's right. I would like to say that for those of you who know about me and have been attracted to my work or interested in my work, that there is one single most important thing that I would like to say to the younger generation, and that concerns the nature of religion by comparison to the nature of true mystical experience.
Exactly.
I've, as you know, you mentioned this also in our preparation. This is something about which I've written a lot, and I want to say that I consider it very encouraging today when I look at the world and when I look at the younger generation as far as they are regarding religion. I see a lot of evidence that people in their 20s or even before their 20s are snapping very fast. Young men and women are snapping to the realization that religion is crap.
Yeah.
And they make no bones about it. It's not as if they're saying, well, we're going to look into it, we're going to see how it works, maybe there's something there. It is just so obvious to many members of the young generation that religion is just a mental control system. There really is no such thing as genuine religion in a spiritual sense in the world today. What people embrace in the mainstream, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and the rest, calling it religion is really just a social control system, and it has some very evil and sinister aspects to it. Well, I find it very encouraging that the instincts of young people today are telling them this, and that they are backing off very strongly and rejecting these the conditioning and the control of religion.
They are seeing that it is a trap.
Right, they're seeing that it is a trap. But at the same time, there's something that really concerns me, and that is this so-called atheist movement.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, if you look on YouTube, you find a great many young people coming forth with their declarations against religion, against Christianity and Islam, and even coming out and saying how sick it all is. Well, I couldn't agree with them more. I mean, if you read my book, Not in His Image,
exactly,
you'll find that I've tried to point to the core of that sickness. I've tried to show that salvationist religion is pathological. By salvationist religion, I mean any religion that presents you with a redeemer figure or someone who is going to make your suffering pay off.
No,
that
exactly.
is really, really sick. And I have exposed that or done it to the best of my ability. But at the same time, when I see these YouTube clips and I hear these young people rejecting religion and calling themselves atheists, it does raise a concern. And I can tell you very simply what that is. I think there may be a danger that when you throw out religion and you reject it,
yeah.
as you well should, that you may also reject mystical experience as a whole and go for some kind of cold atheistic materialism.
Well, that is atheism is a belief system.
Atheism is just another belief system. That's right. And it can be just as much of a trap as religion.
Yeah.
And so that's why I consider it very important, if I can take the opportunity to speak as an elder, to also say out front that I am a mystic. And I call myself a mystic because I've had mystical experiences. And I would like to explain as clearly as I can to the generation today the validity and the authenticity of these mystical experiences by contrast to the religion that they're rejecting, and emphasize not to reject the mysticism with the religion.
Well, there's probably not a whole lot of people like that who can tune into my show for very long. Because I talk a lot about consciousness and spirit, and I've told many of the stories that I've experienced in that direct vein. So I think that if they were that pessimistic, they would have clicked the show off a long time ago.
So what you're saying is they've listened to your accounts of personal mysticism.
Many, yeah. Well, yeah. That's mostly what I've been doing until I started to finally get guests. So I was able to find my feet, so to speak, in the podcasting realm with quite a few shows where I just did it myself. It was just me talking and music and things like that. And
right.
I've told, and this is what I think really I got the most feedback from and the most responses that were, actually I haven't had a single negative response yet. Don't bother to write them, but the thing is that people who are listening gravitated immediately to these stories, to these stories of direct mystical experience, because what I was also trying to do is I was also trying to say, you know, okay, look, there are these plants and these are important, but without a context, they are simply wild experiences, and you need the context, and we don't have the cultural context available to us. And
no, we don't.
That's
one of the reasons why our culture is lost, is because it doesn't provide individuals with a proper context and a discipline, you know, for their mysticism. So you've been offering a very valuable service by speaking directly about this and by talking about the framework that you learned from, you know, working with indigenous people.
Well, also, it was at first I thought, should I share personal stories, you know, and then I thought, well, this is why I started this podcast anyway, was to offer, you know, my experience, just in a sense, for conversation. I'm not trying to be a teacher, I'm just trying to say that, you know, these experiences happen and we need to look at them. That's why I called the program a research vessel, because I wanted to invite that conversation, and I wanted to invite this exact type of dialogue, and that we, as a group, as a humans on this planet, analyze our situation in depth and find, and in these last few shows, especially in some of the coming shows too, is the focus on solutions, the focus on, well, what's the medicinal remedy for this dilemma that the human is in
for the illness of our species, the illness of our species. No, without that kind of sharing and comparing of our experiences, our spiritual experiences, our moments of awakening and enlightenment, I don't think there's any way that we can come to a solution. I think that that is the path. And for me, the path that we are all on as human beings, these paths are very wide and varied. Our species is capable of a vast range of experiences. We are highly imaginative. But it's also important to bear in mind the commonality of our species. In my view, Adam, all of our paths of spiritual exploration are rooted in the same mystical basis.
Yeah.
You know, the word mysticism is very interesting because it goes back to a Greek verb, which is the same as the root of the word mystery. And the Greek verb muein means to murmur or to speak through closed lips. It's a very paradoxical word. But essentially, apart from the literal meaning, what mysticism means, I think, essentially, is it's the experience of wonder and awe, the direct experience of wonder and awe, that each individual can be at the source of creation and at the source of the miracle and mystery of this world, and can reapproach it again and again, and each time be renewed, and each time learn. That is the essence of mysticism, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you said it meant also to speak without words?
Yeah, it means to murmur. It has a paradoxical meaning. It either means to have your mouth closed because you can't speak, or to murmur or whisper something as if it were a secret. So it's a very subtle word.
It sounds to me, as you were explaining it, it seems to say that is a communion with that aspect, the higher
there is indeed,
a connection being made.
Right. There's a saying from the Tao Te Ching that's often quoted, a saying from the ancient Chinese text, those who say don't know, and those who know don't say.
Yeah.
Many people like that saying, but I don't agree with that saying, because I don't believe that the deepest mystical experiences have to remain entirely unexpressed.
No,
of course,
no.
There is always something, as you know, that is unexpressed and cannot be put into words.
I think that's what it means. I think when they're saying that statement, I think that's what it means, because especially when I've read this too, I mean, I'm reading it in a book that's page to page about this topic, so they are expressing it in words, but what they mean is we can only talk about it. We can't tell you what it is.
Well, that's right.
You know,
we cannot tell someone else what it is.
Walk around it, but...
Right. But talking about it and expressing and recounting our personal experiences is extremely important, and the sharing of these mystical experiences is a process, as you were just saying, that we are now understanding can lead us perhaps to come some kind of solution for the dilemma that we've gotten in with our species. You know, on metahistory.org, my site, there's a massive amount of text, and most of it is my writings, you know, as a scholar and a self-taught scholar, and as somebody who suffers from what Don Juan in the Castaneda writings used to call the sorcerer's disease, which is the compulsion to explain things, you know? So I've tried to explain a lot of things on my site, but I have also included in a couple of places a direct testimony of my mystical experiences. And for instance, if you go to the site and go to the site guide and scroll down to an article called Honeycomb Light on the Christos.
I was just thinking about that one because of what you were saying,
Honeycomb Light of the Christos, you will see that I describe in there some personal experiences I have had of what I call the organic light.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I point out, and we discussed this also in preparing this conversation, is that you can have genuine mystical experiences without the use of the plant teachers. And I have had those kind, spontaneous experiences. And you can have them with the use of the plant teachers. The reason why I tend to emphasize reliance on the plant teachers, there are two reasons for that, on the sacred plant medicines, the psychoactive mushrooms and so forth. There are two reasons, and you probably know this already because you've been listening to my talks on Future Primitive, why I emphasize that. One is simply because that has been the tradition in indigenous societies all around the world for thousands of years. You know that through your involvement with the peyote ceremonies, don't you?
Exactly, yeah.
Right. The second reason is more or less of a Lashian spin, I guess you could say. You know, on metahistory.org, I'm trying to develop or present a myth about Gaia, a story about the planet.
Exactly.
That would help us and guide us. So I call it a story to guide the species.
I'm not familiar with this term you just used. You said Lashian. That would be John Lash.
yeah, John Lash. This term is on the internet now.
I've never heard of this school, Lashian. Okay. It's a school of thought. Okay.
Yeah, it's a new word. So anyway, in terms of this vision of Gaia as the superorganism we live in and the living spirit and living intelligence of our planet, well, of course, the sacred plant medicines are very important. They have a priority in Gaia's relationship to us, I would say. She provided us with these plants. Among the many millions of plant species on Earth, exactly, a mere hundreds have these psychoactive properties. She allowed our species to discover these plants, to develop a deep relationship with them in ceremonial terms, in spiritual terms. And so, if I favor the mysticism that comes from using sacred medicine plants, it's quite simply because I think that that kind of mysticism connects us most strongly and securely to the earth and to the intelligence of the earth. And that is, in my mind, a high spiritual goal, to say the least.
Yeah.
It's also totally necessary for our survival that we become connected to the intelligence of the earth.
So that's why
I emphasize that.
I think that's an incredibly valid point, and I also think that's exactly why I say that there's no justification for altering the plants. In that it's a huge leap of arrogance and assumption to think that you're going to take this substance and fix it up better than she has, you know?
I totally agree with you.
We can't cook like that.
No, we can't cook like that. We can't even make a zucchini. We can make an atom bomb.
No, exactly.
But we can't make a zucchini. What does that say about the human species, you know? I totally agree with you, and I think that the story of LSD is an amazing exception to that rule, but it points us back to the essential truth.
Uh-huh.
You know, in Switzerland during the Second World War, Albert Hofmann was an ordinary conventional chemist working for Sandoz Laboratories, and they were actually looking for a drug to sell, a synthetic pill that would help women with pregnant women, and they were looking at ergot because it's known that ergot, which is a fungus of the rye plant, has these properties of contracting the uterus. So they were thinking, well, Albert Hofmann, please go and synthesize some of this ergot because we might be able to then make a pill that we could sell to pregnant women that would help them with the birth process, you see. It was all totally conventional. And the fact that he discovered LSD, he synthesized it without even knowing what it was, and then he actually got it on his fingers, that whole story just enabled something to happen in the world that probably couldn't have happened otherwise. As you well know, Adam, the use of the sacred medicine plants depends a lot on culture and locale.
Uh-huh.
You know, the peyote only grow in a certain area of Mexico, and the Indians who do those fantastic psychedelic paintings of the peyote plants, you know, the Indians whose religion is centered on peyote, have to collect them in a, what's that, the wheat holes, yeah. They have to collect them in a certain way. And so as far as all the sacred plants of Gaia are concerned, the conditions of collecting them are very special. But because Hoffman accidentally synthesized one of her plants, the ergo fungus, which is psychoactive, it suddenly went out, poof, into the entire world. And what it did was it served to bring people's attention to the power of psychoactive chemistry. Now, once we have our attention on that subject, then I would return to the point that you made. There is no better psychoactive chemistry in any laboratory than the one that's in the laboratory of Gaia herself.
Uh-huh. Well, I think we could probably do a whole show just on Hoffman's discovery, but what the one thing I wanted to say about that was that I discovered from my experience with it, and it was very deep, I reached a point where I got a very clear message that, okay, I was to leave this one alone. And this message, I don't think it came from the substance itself. It came from the spiritual energies that I was connecting myself with. What received me were these spirits of the natural realm.
Sure.
And as you say, the Gaia, but it was all the different aspects of the Gaia, the trees, the birds. In the traditional shamanic work with animal spirits, this became my realm for many, many years.
Sure.
For one, I was very suspicious of the human and the human's information, just naturally. I didn't even learn all the reasons why I should have been suspicious at that time until much later. But I just naturally said, you know, I'm getting a million different stories from a million different directions, and I don't think I can trust the source here, you know. And then I learned that I can ask trees. I can ask the hawks and the eagles and even the little ones, you know, even rocks, you know. You can ask directly from the natural world and actually get, you know, a response. And so, in long story short, leaning to that direction, this voice came to me and said, okay, no, this one's purpose is finished here, because it served a specific purpose. And I think this is what its purpose was, for, I'm assuming anyway, for the entire population, is that this was an awakening experience, in a sense, specifically programmed for modern man's consciousness.
That's right.
Because
it was programmed as a message into the human world that points back beyond the human world and points us back to nature. You know, it's remarkable, the research that has been done since LSD was discovered, the research that has been done on the chemistry of the human brain. You know, there are these chemicals in the human brain called the neurotransmitters, and they are responsible for the way our brain works. They are also responsible for the altered states that we can achieve. For instance, when the neurotransmitters are modified, the most common example being when serotonin is raised in the brain, that's a neurotransmitter, then the brain starts to receive and transmit on other frequencies, and we open to these other dimensions. Well, it's relatively easy to talk about these things now, and of course if you go on the internet you can find a vast amount of information, but at the moment when LSD was discovered, and even in the early 60s, we knew very, very little about these neurotransmitters and the chemistry of the brain. Now we know an enormous amount. Yeah. And so, as you say, Adam, it was the discovery of LSD was a signal to our culture to wake up to the way our brains work and to understand how our brains can receive and transmit on other frequencies.
Yeah.
And on top of that, what I consider to be the most wonderful thing about these discoveries is that when we began to list the neurotransmitters chemically, we got up to a list of about, I think, 20 or 25 of them now. We began to list them, and we began to understand their properties. Then some scientists and botanists started to put two and two together.
Exactly.
And they realized that the reason why these psychoactive chemicals, these psychoactive plants like morning glory, ayahuasca, and psilocybe mushrooms work the way they do is because they operate on these neurotransmitting chemicals in a very special way. So that was an incredible revelation for the human species. And it's a very recent revelation in historical terms. It just happened a few seconds ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
When looking at that, and you see the, in a sense, the direct fit, that it can come from a plant and completely fit the receptor that's in your brain.
You know, fantastic.
Anybody
Absolutely.
That's going to turn around and say, well, that's just an accident, or that's not, you know, that's not a good reason to participate with these substances, is like, you're going, okay, you know, I mean, plants grow better in the sun, right, and they get green. Well, that's a good reason to plant them outside. You can argue about that all you want, but I'm sorry, you know.
For me, there's no argument. You know, the case is so clear, and it's not a case that you don't need to be a scientist or a neuroscientist or an ethnobotanist to understand it, you know. It speaks to common sense. It speaks to our natural intelligence that Gaia, who is the overveiling intelligence of the entire planet, would provide our species with tools to communicate with her. I mean, that is the beautiful truth that we now know. We know it scientifically. If you need the proof is there. Mm-hmm. But, of course, indigenous peoples and shamanic cultures have known it for thousands and thousands of years.
Exactly. And as we were talking earlier, you know, that in altering these plants, you're removing yourself from that stream of intelligence in a big, big way. For instance, the mescaline.
Now, mescaline, yeah.
Because this is one I can tell a lot of stories about. I've never tried mescaline itself. I would never do it. To me, that would be like burning down my mother's house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just wouldn't think of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because I understand so much of that experience, and I could never say that there was one part that I could remove with good conscience and keep the other parts. There was a German psychonaut type scientist, and he was really into the mescaline, and his statement was that, you know, I don't think the Creator wants us to feel uncomfortable, and I don't think spiritual experience really has anything to do with being uncomfortable. And so to him, he was saying, it only makes intelligent sense to refine the medicine down to the mescaline so that you can get a very clean and clear experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, oh, yeah, it's just missed the entire point, you know.
Missed the entire point, yeah. The point is that whatever chemicals we might conjure or invent to alter the mind, they must be based on natural substances. So why not look back to the source of those chemicals? You know, the story with mescaline is the same as the story with LSD. Aldous Huxley, in the early 1960s, wrote this famous book, The Doors of Perception. And that book has been extremely influential in informing people about psychoactive trance and visionary trance. But it was based on his experiences of mescaline. Now, it's a brilliant book, and some of the insights and visions that Huxley describes are absolutely brilliant, and they still stand up to this day. But at the end of the day, the doors of perception is only a signal into our culture to look back to the Gaian matrix of intelligence. And I think that one of the most hopeful things, Adam, about these spiritual awakenings and revelations that people are having today is that they are really pointing us back to the planetary mind and the Gaian matrix of intelligence, which is also the matrix of love and ecstasy for all living beings.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree in that. One of the interesting points about Hoffman also is after he discovered that, the only experience that he had that made any kind of correlation or sense to him was the experience that he talked about when he was a child in the woods.
Absolutely, and it was so moving because I had the opportunity to hear him talk about that in person.
Wow.
There was a conference in Basel, well, there was one this year in 2008, which I talked to you a little bit about. But 2 years before, in 2006, there was a conference in Basel, Switzerland, where Sandoz was located. And that's where Hoffman lived all his life. And it happened to occur on January 13th, which was also his 100th birthday. So there was Albert Hoffman on the stage at the big Basel Conference Center. There were a number of other luminaries and scholars from the psychedelic and shamanic world there to celebrate him. It was extremely moving. And he spoke of that very experience, and he spoke of it with beautiful simplicity, that taking LSD brought him back to the sense of awe and the connection with nature that he had had in his boyhood. So Hoffman, Albert Hoffman, was also pointing in the very direction that we're discussing here.
Yeah, and in a sense there was, maybe you could call it synchromystical choice of the universe for him to be this one to discover and to bring it into our realm. And I think the last piece of evidence that I would say points to its purpose for modern consciousness, and in a sense I would say a limited purpose, although big, is that it arrived at the same time as the nuclear bomb, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Almost.
Yeah, at the very same time.
Yeah.
So
and
the choice is
that
clear.
That was a huge time, you know, as you know by what I've heard you talk about 1947 and things like this. This was a big time where things were really starting to, in a sense, some huge doors were opened at that time.
Well, it seems like the destructive potential of our species, the self-destructive potential, emerged at that time and has been running out of control since then. The other thing that I see that happened in the 40s is the beginning of the danger, the immense danger that we face on the planet due to mind control and the kinds of mind control programming that were investigated, you know, by the CIA and so forth. Did you know that in the already in the 50s, the CIA in the United States was ordering millions of doses of LSD from Sandoz?
Well, exactly. I mean, they are the ones who released it to the population, and even to
they did indeed. They
Timothy
are
Leary
the
and
government is always behind the drug movements that it's fighting. You know,
it's obviously a scam, but this one seems to have at least in the Merry Pranksters. What's his name?
Ken Kesey.
Ken Kesey. In Ken Kesey's term, it had a blowback effect that they didn't expect, and I think that's true. So I think that there are some truly mystical properties to its arrival, to its purpose, and to its effect on the world. And I think the fact that it came in the hands of the CIA really illustrates just the complexity of how these things actually work in our world, and also who's really in charge, you know?
Absolutely, it does. One of the other things that's I often think about when I look back on the 60s is that we were at somewhat of a disadvantage then. There was LSD, and of course it came upon the scene with a great and a spectacular crash. And it, you know, it really blew the minds of a lot of people. That was a full-blown, yeah, I have to tell you, you know, it was pretty damn exciting to be involved in my teens in a full-blown global psychedelic revolution. There were moments there when that was pretty wild. And we thought that the world was going to be changed forever. But one of the disadvantages that we had at that time, which made it difficult to evaluate what LSD, you know, was doing to us, was that we didn't really know very much about shamanism and the indigenous practices. So today, you know, some 40 years later or better, we have a much better chance to evaluate. In the little talk that we had before we began this evening, you used the word discernment. It's such an important word. Discrimination and discernment in the use of these substances and in the whole realm of psychonautics is extremely important. And since the 60s, we've learned so much about shamanism, we've learned so much about the use of iboga, ayahuasca, peyote, all of these traditional plants in a sacred way, that we have a much better chance now to use them in a sacred way and in a correct way. I find that very encouraging development.
Well, that was just the first half of my conversation with John Lash. And we will continue this conversation in part two of our 10th expedition aboard the Psychonautilus. Well, the Chronicles of the Psychonautilus now has its own form. It is still a bit in construction. It's not the style I wanted to use, so we are waiting to get uploaded with a new style. But it is there and it works, and you can sign up and put your avatars in there. So there we can go further into the information and the discoveries that we make on board the Psychonautilus, and we will dig deeper within the research and the discovery of this infinite and boundless multiverse.
Thank you.
welcome back to the second part of our 10th expedition aboard the Psychonautilus. In the background, we are listening to another one of James Songer's songs, where he is playing using the Lucy scale. And this is Japanese plus low. And we will continue now with our conversation with John Lash. John Lash is the author of Not in His Image, also Quest for the Zodiac, and other very interesting books. He is the co-founder and principal author of the metahistory.org site, and you can find many of his conversations and dialogues on Future Primitive as well. That is the companion site to metahistory.org, and that is futureprimitive.org. I've been really enjoying just going through all the different podcasts that they have on that site. Some really fantastic conversations. So if you liked the first half of my conversation with John Lash, you're going to really like the second half. So now we dive much deeper into the topics that we started, into the nature of psychonautics. What does it mean to be the pilot of your own soul and your own mind? Let's do that. Let's fast forward now and look at where we're at now, because I think this is what is so important at this time. Because as we were saying, we are starting to become, as a people, even though it is a small minority, the people that are aware of it, we're starting to realize and actually experience the fact that we are multidimensional beings, and we are entering into a multidimensional world, whether you're using these substances or not. And I personally know many people who and a lot of times these people can be quite tragic in that they're having spontaneous spiritual experiences throughout their day and their life without any kind of understanding of what the heck is going on. And unfortunately, a lot of these people wind up in our institutions and things like this because nobody understands what is going on for them. I'm not saying there's not a lot of actual psychological problems in the world, but a lot of it, I think, is people having experiences of just what we're talking about, but without any context.
And without any context, and also without knowing where to go with those experiences, without any consistency. You know, Stan Grof was a great pioneer of the first generation of psychonauts and is still living today and teaching. He was at the Basel conference last March as well. Stan Grof has written a wonderful book called When the Impossible Happens, in which he summarizes a lot of the kinds of experiences we're talking about. And he and his wife, Christina Grof, coined this term, spiritual emergencies.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And he
That's what I'm talking
term
about.
Precisely for what you're talking about. You know, they used to be called in the 70s, in the derogatory language of psychiatry, they used to be called schizophrenic breakdowns.
Yeah.
We're now understanding that schizophrenia is not a rare condition that a few weird people suffer from. It is actually an inherent threshold state for our species. And so our species has a schizophrenic potential, and it's because we have that potential that we can shift into other modes and frequencies of consciousness. But then, once we do that, if we can't navigate, getting back to the psychonaut idea,
exactly, the
if
navigation.
We can't navigate in those new dimensions, then we're going to be in really big trouble. So for me, Adam, the key question today is, you know, what are the tools of navigation that we have? What are the tools of guidance for people who are responding to the great moment of revealing?
Well, especially since when you're talking about schizophrenia, is that what many, many people are finding, especially through the more exciting plants, is that when you find yourself in these realms, you find out you're not alone in these realms, and that there are people that live in these realms, and you're a visitor. So
that's right.
This ability for discernment. Now, I learned this sometimes the hard way, and by becoming so psychedelically immersed, in a sense, the blowing away of the boundaries. And if you're if you can't find your body anymore, you know, how do you find yourself? And this is
right.
Where I came under, became able to recognize what is referred to as the authentic self, and began to learn how to anchor into that authentic self.
That is a valuable tool. I think that the essence of the problem, if I might try to summarize it in just one phrase, is that it's completely, or I say ultimately, a problem of grounding. It's a problem of grounding, Adam, because look, you know from your experiences in indigenous cultures that the use of sacred plants, be it peyote or whatever, was always done in a cultural context of that tribe. It was done at a certain season. It was done ceremonially. Now, let's face the music, folks. The fact is that we're living in a global society which has lost all of those kinds of tools and totally lost that understanding. So what happens is people are going to be plunged into altered states. They're going to have spiritual emergencies, and they're going to not have the old ancient tools for orientation. That's inevitable. We can count on it being that way. So what can we do? What can we do about that situation? I think that I would address that by saying that the most important thing about any visionary experience or any schizophrenic state is to be grounded with that experience, to be grounded. And whatever grounds you back into sanity is going to help you manage it. In my opinion, the ultimate grounding force is the Earth, is the planet that we stand on.
Exactly.
That's why I try to emphasize that all of our visions and all of our various experiences, which can be extremely diverse, should ultimately focus on our connection to Gaia and the living planet. That's the ultimate grounding force.
Because we are truly electrical beings, and that's what you would do with electricity, so why wouldn't you do it with yourself?
That's right. We know now that our cells are electrical units, that they transmit. Every cell in our body, not just the cells in our brains, but every cell in your body is an electromagnetic unit that transmits and receives in the electromagnetic field of the Earth itself. And so we are cells in Gaia's body. And the great awakening for us is to become connected to the larger superorganism in which we live. You know, a lot of my work has to do with mythology. As you know, I sometimes call myself a mythologist because of, just to put a label on myself. But what is a mythologist, really? It's just somebody who deals with the stories that humanity has told itself down the ages, the myths of Greece or Rome or Siberia or Polynesia or Egypt or whatever. And I've investigated a great many of these myths, as you know, because I'm a comparative mythologist. And yet I found one particular myth that I think more than any of the others tells us the story of the Earth and the story of this planet we live on. And of course that's the myth that I discovered in the writings of the Gnostics. And that's the myth of the goddess Sophia, or the fallen goddess. So in my book, Not in His Image, I've made an effort to retell this myth, to reconstruct it and retell it in 9 episodes, because I think it would be a story that would guide us and would have a tremendous grounding value in terms of these mystical experiences we're talking about.
Yeah, in the indigenous ways that I'm familiar with, you know, the elders always said, hey, if you have something important to say, sit down. You know, don't talk about these things standing up. You know,
that's right.
My grandfather teacher is always saying, hey, look, sit down. Don't talk about that standing up, waving your arms around.
Right.
Sit, if it's important, you speak about it sitting on the ground and not on a chair, he says, on the ground.
Right, on the ground itself. You know, I think that the discovery of the so-called Gaia hypothesis is just a scientific idea that was proposed in the early 70s. And the basis of the idea is so simple. It is that the Earth is a living, self-regulating organism. I consider that Gaia notion to be so tremendously important. You know, one of the things that we saw emerge in the 60s during the psychedelic revolution was that fantastic photograph of the Earth. And that was the first time that we could really see the blue planet that we inhabit from outside. And I think from that moment on, something was planted in the human species, an understanding of what Gaia is, of what this planet is. And we just need that understanding to guide these visionary experiences. For me, all mysticism and all visionary experiences are in, that is the context now, Adam. We've lost the other contexts. We don't have the tribal rites anymore. We don't have the rites of passage, but we have a new context in this story and vision of Gaia.
Well, exactly. I would say, I mentioned this before, but I wanted to repeat it, what you said about the tribal rites is that now when I was being taught by the one I always refer to as my grandfather teacher, he made it really clear that I wasn't to practice tribal ways. He wanted me to learn the principles of these ceremonial practices. He didn't want me to just imitate tribal ways. So anytime it was like simply a tribal cultural aspect to it, he said, "You look, just don't bother with that, you know. I wasn't going to dress up and, you know, I'm not going to criticize people, but some people can take the feathers and the beads and everything a bit far."
They can, they can. And there's a lot of kind of, there can be a charade around
exactly.
Shamanism.
Exactly. Well,
now, shamanism
the
has
first teacher I met, he said, you know, there's not much difference. He said there's a short distance between a showman and a shaman.
There's a very short distance, and I'd also point out that the word shaman begins with the word S-H-A-M, which is a sham, which is a fraud, you know? And now that shamanism has become so mainstream, there's a fair amount of fraudulent activity that goes under that label. But then again, I think, back to the question, well, discernment, evaluation, you know, how do we measure what is correct and what is right? And I would say, well, if it's teaching you about the Earth and about our connection to the Earth and about the life of our planet as a whole, then that's the right direction, and that is not fraudulent.
Yeah, and there's a lot, you know, about holding people up on pedestals, too. For instance, I've met many roadmen. We call them road chiefs, we call them roadmen. I've met many, that's within the peyote way. I've also met medicine men who've never eaten peyote in their life and recommend that you don't. You know, so I've been lucky to participate with many different medicine peoples. Okay, but they're human, and I've seen them fall down, and I've seen some of the most powerful, as you say, people say, oh, he's a powerful shaman. I say, well, the power is not his. If he's actually a powerful shaman, he will tell you this. This power is not his. This is what
right.
he is able to access.
Right.
And if he's claiming it's his, then we're getting into the shaman, we're getting into the sham aspect of it again. And, you know, for instance, there was a roadman, I don't necessarily mention his name, but he came from Oklahoma, and when he was a young man, he was a boxer, and he was really active, really gregarious, and I would say handsome, very handsome. We used to call him the Peyote Elvis.
And, mm-hmm. Wow.
But the thing about this man was, in that teepee, when... in the presence of peyote, I have rarely seen anybody more qualified and also more capable of using the medicine properly. Let's put it that way. And if you're a medicine man, you're using the medicine properly. You're not the medicine, you know?
Right.
You know
what I'm saying?
Right. And so, oh, he was, he had flashing and style and, you know, he was a bit of a ladies man and all these things, you know, and these were also his weaknesses, but he also had some incredible ability. And so I would say, you know, a very real medicine man in a great sense. Well, you know, he passed away one night after he drank too much and he crashed his car into a tree and died.
Sure.
And
sure.
So all that aside, you know,
sure.
He was still human and still failed and was able to fall down many times and pick himself back up and go back and do it again. But when he was, you know, called into service in a sense, he was a master. So
right. Well,
it taught me a lot.
Because he could make certain connections, and we can all make those connections. The important thing is that an individual will make connections to the planet and to the matrix, the biological and spiritual matrix. And it's not about personal power or personal identity. It's about the capacity to make and share those connections. That's all. And we're all totally equal in that respect. We're all capable of making a vast, of being a link and an intermediary through a vast number of wonderful forces.
Exactly.
And that's what really matters. And that's why the sacred plants are so unique, because they are connectors and intermediaries as well. And they teach us how to become so ourselves, egolessly,
yeah.
But without ego. There's no personal investment in it, and there's no personal payoff either. The payoff, is, if you want to use that word, is that we return to the ecstasy that's our natural birthright, the place
right.
that we never really left in the first place, but we believe that we've left that place of ecstasy. And when we get back to that ecstasy, then all the solutions are at hand.
Yeah, and we kind of come around to the aspect, too, of how it doesn't matter what you've experienced, it's how you incorporate it into your life. And if you don't incorporate it into your life, well, you can. It doesn't matter how many people you've healed or how close to Creator you've gotten. You're still wrapping
right.
a car around a tree, you know?
That's right, yeah.
And fall down and look stupid.
If you drink too much, yeah.
Or it won't save you from yourself.
No, it won't.
We have
no.
to do this. And when we talk about the discernment in shamanic realms, when you're in these extraordinary realms and you find entities within these realms, like we were talking, that these entities are coming from, in a sense, all directions. There's as much texture to the population in out-of-body realms as there is to the populations within our physical
realms. Absolutely, that's a good point.
I think it actually mirrors it. I mean, I think you could say that it's equal in some senses. There's a mirroring. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. The variety of entities that inhabit these dimensions is probably some reflection of our human variety in a way. So getting back to our main point here, Adam, about
yes.
the direction of the psychonautic movement today, I think that what we've been discussing here for the last hour really addresses that subject very well, and I'm glad that we have been able to talk about that. You know, in my book, Not in His Image, and in a lot of what I've written on the site, I talk about the ancient pagan mysteries of Europe, the mysteries that were practiced de Eleusis and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And I do that a lot because I find in these ancient mysteries also a kind of example or model for our mystical experiences today, you know? And the key thing about the practice of mysticism in those mysteries is that they did use psychoactive plants. That's totally confirmed now by, you know, research if you need that kind of thing.
Right.
They did use them, and secondly, returning to the point you made earlier, they use them intentionally. That is the key word. You go into these experiences with intention. I am completely opposed to the recreational use of magic mushrooms and so forth, I think it could be okay one or two times for people to ingest mushrooms and in order to get used to the idea of what they do, you know, because it would be a completely novel experience for some people to eat magic mushrooms and see what that's like. But then once you are at ease with doing that, it's absolutely imperative to have an intention before you go into the experience and take that intention with you. And I am a strong advocate of intentional experiences, because I think that the recreational use of these sacred plants is really a crime and a waste of time.
Well, it's I find that recreational use is very common for a lot of first-time experiences.
Right, first-timers, right.
And I think that the universe has some form of benevolence in that situation, too. Sometimes I've seen...
Call them deeper.
Yeah, well, sometimes
I've
seen...
Yeah, to call them to a deeper experience.
Or not to present them with more than they can handle.
Ah,
you know, at that time. I've seen people come into peyote ceremonies for the very first time and just sit up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed the whole night and not have one uncomfortable moment. And I say, well, you know, she is gentle, and she's not going to get you to face the fire when all you're doing is getting your feet wet, you know.
Right.
And as you become experienced, as you become willing to do the work, well, then you start actually the process, and it can get harder and harder and harder. And sometimes the deeper you go and the further you go in this work, the harder your life becomes, because this stuff comes up, and it comes up in various different forms, you know. And to take this path seriously, you just can't. Like I'm agreeing with you. I cannot endorse recreational use over extended periods of time.
Not over extended periods of time. Not
because,
at all. No.
Well, I'm even going to warn against it. You will endanger yourself. You are going to experience a dissolution of boundaries without what we said, discernment, without focus, and you make yourself a victim. You know,
that could very well be true, and that is something to avoid, of course. In my mind, though, again, it's a serious misuse of the sacred plants. They've been given to us for a purpose, and we should use them with purpose. It's as simple as that. And I also want to say I appreciate hearing about your experiences and the various trials that you've gone through and the difficulties that have been presented to you, and I understand that can happen. But I have to say that that's not my experience at all with psychoactive plants. I experience it as an accelerating and escalating learning process. And each time that I do a practice, which I generally do with psychoactive mushrooms, I prefer to use certain species that I know very well, I don't have to face any personal stuff. I just am brought into a sublime experience of learning. I know that these teacher plants can be kind of therapists. I know they can work that way, and they will be your therapist if you need them to be.
Right.
But I also want to say that in my experience, there's very little therapy that comes up when I use the plants for experimental mysticism. Very little therapy comes up at all, and it's much more of a huge learning process and an adventure in ecstasy and in revelation.
Well, you've had the benefit of coming from a clearer perspective in the beginning. I feel that was when I'm talking about difficulties, I'm definitely talking about the beginnings of my I'd say journey, because it is a journey that you begin and you choose and you start. So at that time, you know, life was pretty rough. I was 16, and I was dealing with, you know, a lot of things. Well, you only have to face what you're holding on to, right? And if you've already
Absolutely.
Let it go.
Absolutely. No, I understand. I understand your viewpoint very well.
Yeah. I'm simply saying that I totally understand what you mean. I mean, because by the time that you have let this stuff go and you've gotten to this clarity, Well, yeah, it's not there. And
no, there's a kind of platform that you can reach,
yeah,
a kind of level that you can reach where it really becomes, I would say, consistently a transpersonal experience. And although the plant teachers can be terrific therapists, and they certainly are tremendous healers, psychic healers and physical healers, as you know, I've been deeply physically healed by these plants time and time again. They, at a certain level, it becomes just purely an adventure of learning and an ongoing revelation. And it becomes very, very easy and joyful, actually.
Uh-huh. I enjoyed your talk about what you call the organic light.
Yes.
And also you had mentioned oceanic consciousness.
That's right.
And I just wanted to say my two experiences with those two things had absolutely nothing to do with any form of psychedelic plant at all. The only time I actually experienced complete oceanic consciousness was through the practice of Qigong.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, you know, in a meditation after a Qigong practice, the bottom dropped out.
Right.
And
fantastic.
And it lasted for quite a while. That was extraordinary. And the first time I think I saw, if I'm correct in your description of what the organic light is and how it is that you see it. Well, I told this story in an earlier podcast, but I got my, because I really don't have a clue of time, I got my age wrong. I was around 8.
Mm.
And I had said earlier I was 12. So, but I had witnessed a young boy die in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
He was hit by a car. And as I'm looking at his face, you remember the old TVs when you turn them off and you see the lights spread out across the screen and then it just goes into one tiny point?
Right.
And there's almost like a little burst at the end?
Right.
They don't do that anymore. They just go click. But
no, but I know exactly what you're describing, yeah.
As I'm looking at him, there's this subtle light to his face that you don't perceive until you don't see it anymore. Like, I wasn't aware I was seeing a light within his face until I actually saw that light go out.
Right, exactly. Well, that's quite an observation to make at a young age.
Well, it for years taught me over and over and over again what was that and the meditation on it. I learned more and more about the actual, it actually showed me directly that we are not anchored to this body, that we simply inhabit this body, and it led to many out-of-body experiences because I saw it happen.
Mm.
And I also experienced his spirit directly outside of his body when, at that moment when he exited his body, then we were sharing the same thoughts, and it was the same confusion, like, what the heck is happening? And in my mind, I'm saying to him, I think you're dead, you know?
Right.
He's like, oh, no. But in telling him that he was dead, he was able to orient himself, and, well, I don't know what happened. He moved on because there was so much chaos around me with the cops and the cars and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
I went into a state of shock. But at that moment, when it was just him and me on the street right after this, right immediately after he was hit, and I don't remember actually being able to hear a single sound, there was a complete stillness, and I saw I saw him transfer from his physical realm to his spiritual realm.
That's remarkable, really.
So I saw this light, and you were describing it as subtle, almost imperceptible, not like big flash, you know.
No, it does not shine. It does not radiate brilliantly and like a lightning flash overwhelm your perception. It does not catch your perception in that way. It catches your perception in a very subtle way. And I've, in those talks on Future Primitive, I've tried to explain that. I've also explained it in Not in His Image. And I'm very careful when I talk about the organic light, at least I try to be, because I consider it to be perhaps the most supremely important subject of mysticism. Certainly it was considered to be the supreme secret of mysticism, because the people in the mystery schools of ancient Europe who perceived that light and used it in their methodology considered it a sacred vow, what they could say about that light, and they were very careful as to what they said about it. So to me, it's an extremely sacred topic, and one that needs to be explained and brought out in the open right now more and more.
Well, you did it very well, because
thank you
for one. But as you had also said in that same talk, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't really understand your description.
It's possible, and you know, people are responding to the site, and people have written in to me about their experiences of glimpsing this organic light. Of course, you can glimpse the organic light without use of psychoactive plants. I saw it three times before I ever saw it in a visionary trance with mushrooms. So you can see it both ways, but the important thing, the key thing is, can you see it consistently?
Yeah.
And that only comes with discernment and with practice.
With what my Qigong teacher continually said, cultivation.
Cultivation.
And in that school of medicine, actually, there are colors to the organic light, and it is used in diagnosis.
Yeah, there are hues to the organic light. That's true. But
yeah,
the basic,
especially in
the basic
face.
Light itself is a pearly type of opalescent color, but it has a whole mother of pearl spectrum of colors within it.
Well, in the Chinese medicine anyway, especially when you're not well, these colors that you can see in this light, when they're teaching it to you too, they'll say, you know, I mean, as some of the teachers even say, I've never seen this, but this is what it says in the writings,
right?
You know, and they say that there's colors to it. And I learned, because I already knew from my experience with the boy, you know, that, oh yeah, this is what I need to look for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to, in a sense, see these colors and hues, but not to be able to use it in diagnosis. There's so much in their diagnosis I can't even begin to use.
Well, once again, you're very lucky to have had this training. And as we were saying before, the great danger of our time is that we have an opportunity for these spiritual awakenings, but we don't really have the context in order to evaluate them properly. And that is, of course, a great, great crisis point for our species. I think that we are going to, you know, make it or break it pretty much on the basis of that, don't you?
Well, I do. And this is also a point that you brought up. This is where the plant teachers come in. And I'm not just talking psychotropic plants.
No,
I mean
plants.
That plant consciousness on this planet has been completely neglected.
I know.
Because we haven't been skilled
enough.
And
plants are the most numerous species of, they're the most numerous species on the planet. They're the most numerous inhabitants, our plants.
There's I think it's actually a song, it's a peyote song that says, you know, if Jesus came back and he was a plant, would you talk to him?
Yeah, right.
The thing about that is that, well, you saw The Secret Life of Plants, I'm sure, or read the book.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What the most wonderful thing about that is these experiments which actually show you right up into your face that even a cabbage plant, you know, is conscious. And so you certainly don't need a brain for consciousness. So I always laugh when you hear, you know, people talk about downloading someone's brain into a computer. I'm thinking, you do that with a broccoli, I'm going to be impressed, okay?
Yeah, that's right.
Because you might be talking about downloading someone's, you know, recording of EEG waves, all right? But you're not putting consciousness into this computer.
No, well, that's part of the madness of our time. That's part of the madness of scientific materialism, that they think they're gods and they can act like gods with consciousness, and they don't have the faintest idea what consciousness is.
No.
No respect for it either.
Exactly. That's the arrogance of science. But you remember the experiment where, it was a Russian one, where the woman, it was two cabbage plants, one was hooked up to the polygraph, and one wasn't, and a whole line of scientists came through the room, and then one of the women, this big burly Russian woman, when she came up to that cabbage plant, they were all touching, by the way, the plant that wasn't hooked up.
Right.
So they were reading the readings of the plant that was hooked up, but nobody ever touched it. Then she tore the plant from limb to limb, right next to the other cabbage plant. Well, in witnessing the murder of its fellow cabbage plant, this little plant just went, you know, blacklined off the scale.
Absolutely.
It just completely blackened its little line graph chart. And it took it like an hour to calm down after that.
Yeah.
So then
yeah.
They waited 5 hours. They reorganized the line of people. And they brought them back into the room in a different order. Well, the plant was totally cool with everybody. But when that woman who tore up
sure.
the plant walked through the door, she didn't even get into the room. She just came in through the door. It started to instantly freak out again.
Well, that's a story that many people may not know, because The Secret Life of Plants, of course, was brought out in the 70s, and it was very well known at the time, and it was a bestseller, but I haven't
seen... How did it vanish like that? I mean,
I don't know. It's a fantastic book by Peter Tompkins.
You can find it on YouTube. If you want to watch 5-minute segments of it, you can watch the entire thing on YouTube.
No, it's absolutely fantastic book, and your story is a wonderful one that everyone should know, because in my mind, it points again to the main, the essential thing, which is that... whatever mystical experiences we have, whatever awakenings we have now.
Sorry.
There's a dog awakening. Who is that dog? That's got a very gruff voice.
Yeah, he's the okay. His name is Cummy.
I think it might be a sign we should draw this to a close, Adam.
Well, To wrap that up, this is a good topic to end on, because...
Yeah, I was just going to say that the story of your cabbages points to the infinite aliveness of everything around us. And so this is what our mysticism should show
awareness.
Us, too.
But it has to also show that they're not just alive, they're aware, you know?
That's right. The mysticism that we practice, if we make it a discipline and if we make it something of purpose... rather than random, then it should just lead to that. It should just lead us more and more into this infinite aliveness that's around us and the infinite aliveness of our own being. And I think with that, we cannot fail to find a new direction for humanity. And boy, do we need that right now, more than anything.
We really do, because we also need the intelligence within these entities, these beings that live with us in silence. There's a massive amount of intelligence. My grandfather teacher, he will always say that, you know, there's no scientist on this planet that knows as much as this peyote. They can't even get close, you know. They're like children compared to that. And that if you ask this peyote these questions, you know, it'll tell you. And we talked about taking them apart and using just specific parts of them.
Right.
Peyote has 18 different psychoactive alkaloids.
That's right.
It has over 300 and I don't know how many different chemical compounds. It's an incredibly complex plant, and you can find petrified peyote, which means it's millions of years old. It's exactly identical to what it is now.
That's right.
So since its beginning, it hasn't changed. It hasn't done anything. It came into this planet as it is and has remained for millions of years. So when you're talking about a very powerful and ancient being, and if you want to know something, because what we're talking about, we're missing our elders, you know?
That's right.
I mean, we're lucky to find them when we can, and we should really honor them and make them aware that we appreciate them. So I'm also saying that to you, in that I'm recognizing your... that I heard this in your voice from the very first guy. I said, here is one of our elders, this man, you know? And that... these plants, these are plants that we can turn to, and we can ask them, you know, what are the original instructions?
Mm-hmm, that's right. What are the original instructions? Exactly.
So.
Well, that's a good question to leave our conversation with, I think, because it sums up just about everything we've been talking about.
Okay, well, I really, really do appreciate that you responded to my request, and that... yeah, we were able to get together for this, and this was just really fantastic for me. I really appreciate it.
Me as well. I've enjoyed talking with you a lot, Adam, and I've learned from our conversation. So thank you.
Okay, well, and thank you. And I will put up of course, all the information about your recent works and the website and stuff. And I hope that we could do this sometime again. Actually, you know, anytime you ever want to come on this show, you have a standing invitation.
Thanks. Well, the next time, let's talk about sex.
Okay.
Because that's another subject that's very closely related to the shift of humanity right now, and it would be fun to talk about. So we'll look forward to that.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Bye for now.
Okay, bye-bye.